Good day. Today is Friday, 24th July 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me take this opportunity first to thank everybody for their very kind and supportive words which they sent to me after I informed everyone of my illness yesterday. This is all highly appreciated, both by myself and by my wife. As you can all see, today I am indeed better. Anyway, let us with that proceed now to the substance of the video. And even as I am making this programme, at this moment in time, reports are pouring in of another big Russian missile and drone strike against Kiev. A missile and drone strike, incidentally, which is taking place in daytime, with indications again that Ukrainian air defence is incapable of parrying the blow. Now, I don't have a full picture yet of the extent of this Russian missile and drone strike on Kiev. There is word that Iskander M missiles, ballistic missiles, are again being used, and that Tsarkon hypersonic missiles are being used as well. There's word that up to 10 Iskander M ballistic missiles have been used so far, and 4 Tsarkon missiles. But as we are apparently in the early hours of this strike, it is quite possible that more targets will be hit and more missiles will be used, and we will learn more about it over the course of the day. Now, inevitably, some are linking this further Russian missile and drone strike on Kiev to a Ukrainian drone attack on Russia, which took place last night, which I will come back to shortly. But I will say straight away that I don't think so. There's been rumours that the Russians were preparing another big strike on Kiev, circulating for several days. And I believe that some of these rumours have been circulated by none other than President Zelensky himself. But as I have said previously, and as General Gerasimov, the overall Russian military commander, also confirmed, it seems much more likely that these Russian strikes on Kiev, like the continued strikes that are hammering Odessa, more about those shortly, as well as the Russian drone offensive destroying the gas filling stations across eastern and central Ukraine, another important targets, warehouses and such things across eastern and central Ukraine, all form part of a single wider strategy which is aligned with Russia's ground strategy, its offensive on the ground. In other words, if there had not been a Ukrainian drone attack on Kiev, a Ukrainian drone attack on Russia last night, it is highly likely, in fact, I'm sure, that a Russian strike, exactly the same Russian strike that we are seeing carried out against Kiev today, that strike would have happened anyway. If I am going to venture a guess, and this is purely a guess, I would guess that last night's Ukrainian drone attack on Russia is more likely to have been timed to precede a Russian strike on Kiev, which the Ukrainians already knew was coming, rather than that the Russian strike on Kiev today was provoked by that Ukrainian strike. But I want to stress this is a guess, and of course it is a complex operation for the Ukrainians to carry out a major drone attack on Russia. So probably the attacks, the two attacks, the fact that they're happening one after the other, is mere coincidence. Anyway, there it is. So I can't speak of the targets the Russians are striking. The fact that they are striking in the middle of the day, however, tells us two things. Firstly, the collapse of air defences in Kiev. Secondly, the ability of the Russians to conduct strikes on Kiev at extremely short notice using ballistic missiles, ground-launched ballistic missiles, and hypersonic missiles, cruise missiles, launched from their territory, so that the Ukrainians now are getting only very, very short notice. And it could be, it may just be, that another further reason for this Russian strike is the fact that apparently there is a delegation from Raytheon, the US manufacturer that produces Patriot missiles, in Kiev at the present time. And the Russians wanted to demonstrate to the people from Raytheon the effectiveness of their missiles and the futility of continuing to supply air defences to Kiev. But I think it more likely that that was a coincidence too. Now, with all of that, let's turn now to the Ukrainian attack on Russia. This is a big attack. According to the Russians, something like 570 to 600 drones were used in total. And it was an interesting attack in certain respects. Firstly, the target was not Russian refineries or oil facilities. The Ukrainians seem to have largely given up attacks on Russian refineries and oil facilities. And the Russians, for the record, are now continuing to say that the situation in the gas and oil sector is stabilizing. There's been more reports about this in the Russian media. There was a lengthy discussion about this in the Russian newspaper Kommersant, saying that the situation with oil and gasoline and diesel on the Russian markets, domestic markets, continues to stabilize. And I don't think there is any realistic doubt about this. The refineries are all coming back online. The repairs have been mostly done. The market is being saturated with petrol, gasoline, imported in some cases from countries like Kazakhstan and India. As I said, the situation overall with energy across what you might refer to as pre-2014 Russia is now quickly returning to stability. Yesterday, I discussed how the Ukrainians did conduct another strike on two oil facilities. And apparently a refinery in southern Russia. But these attacks were the exception to the current rule, which is that my guess is because the refineries are becoming ever harder targets, the Ukrainians are no longer attacking them in the way that they previously did. So this Ukrainian strike involving hundreds of drones, I say 570 to 600 drones, once again, it's obvious that the main target was Wildberries, the Russian equivalent of Amazon. Only note that it is not the only Russian equivalent of Amazon. Online retailing, e-commerce in Russia is now highly developed, and there are lots of companies involved in it, Ozone being another one, but also apparently smaller platforms. Wildberries, however, is the biggest and the most famous. And by the way, it is not only active in Russia, it is active in Central Asia as well. It is an enormous operation. Apparently, its annual operations are in the region of $100 billion, which is a substantial operation by any measure, but of course a particularly big operation in Russian terms. And the attempt this time was to destroy Wildberries warehouses in the vicinity of Russia's second biggest city and former capital, St. Petersburg. And the drones, the hundreds of drones that were launched, basically were aimed mostly towards St. Petersburg. And the Russian Defense Ministry claims that it shot down far and away the greater number of these drones, but the Russians confirm that some targets were attacked and that a Wildberries warehouse in the village of Novosaratovka in Leningrad region's Vsevolozhsk district was hit by a drone and did catch fire. Now, I think that the Ukrainians believed that they were attacking two Wildberries warehouses, because they also attacked a warehouse in a settlement known as Sinyavino in the Kirovsk district, which I presume is also located in the Leningrad region. However, the Russians say that this was not a facility connected to Wildberries in any respect, that it was in fact owned by a large poultry farm, which makes it a strange target for the Ukrainians to want to attack. Anyway, one warehouse owned by Wildberries was undoubtedly hit in St. Petersburg and considerable damage was done. Other than that, I have to say that as of now, I don't know of any further damage done to St. Petersburg at all, despite the huge numbers of drones that were launched against the city. We can see, in some respects, the difficulties the Ukrainians are having. In order to hit targets like the Wildberries warehouse in St. Petersburg, hundreds of drones have to be launched in the knowledge that only a very few will eventually get through. And in fact, there is footage, I believe, of the drone that hit the Wildberries warehouse. And some are claiming that it was only one drone that got through, which suggests that the attrition rate amongst the drones that the Ukrainians launched was extremely high. Now, the Ukrainians did also attack another location, and this is some kind of industrial facility in the Kirov region, which is located much further away and which is in northeastern Russia. I've actually been to the city of Kirov. It is on the main railway line to the Urals, to the Ural city of Perm, and the train stopped there, and I briefly visited the place, which has a kind of fame because it was also the place where many years ago, some years ago now, the Russian political oppositionist Alexei Navalny was once placed on trial. Anyway, so there was an attack on some kind of industrial facility in the Kirov region, apparently close to the city of Kirov. The speculation that this industrial facility was in some way involved in military production. The Russians are being very, very careful not to tell us very much about it. But in this strike, there were heavy casualties. Six workers at this factory, whatever it was, were killed, and several more, many more, were injured. So this is the other target that the Ukrainians attacked. There's some dispute as to what exactly hit this facility in Kirov. Some Russian reports say that it was a drone, that this was a drone pack. Others say that it was a missile, perhaps a Flamingo missile that managed to get through all of the defenses as they were preoccupied with what was happening in St. Petersburg. So this is all at the moment very difficult and uncertain to fully understand. Maybe the major target that the Ukrainians were attacking was this industrial facility in the Kirov region. Maybe the attack on St. Petersburg was a diversion. But whatever, let's take a step back and think about what the Ukrainians have in fact achieved. They've hit an industrial facility in the Kirov region, which may play a role in producing weapons for the Russian military. Though the Kirov region is not one of the more heavily industrialized regions of Russia, and I would guess that whatever damage was done would be quickly repaired, especially if this was a military industrial facility. And a vast amount of drones were used to strike at St. Petersburg, but the overall effect was the destruction or damage done to a Wildberries warehouse, and apparently some lesser damage to the warehouse of a poultry farm. If one takes a step back and looks at this objectively, this does not look very impressive. Compare this with the colossal strikes that the Russians have been conducting over the last few weeks on Odessa and on the Odessa region, which continue unrelentingly, or the Russian drone offensive to destroy the gasoline filling stations in eastern and central Ukraine, which also continues unrelentingly. Now, a few weeks ago, shortly after I returned from my trip to Russia, I said that one of the things that really struck me about Russia is the strange atmosphere of normalcy that exists in Russia. The fact that the country overall appears to be very much at peace, that normal life and normal activity continues without there being much sense that there is a war going on, and that this appeared to me to be very much part of the Kremlin's policy. They want to preserve an appearance or a feeling of peace and normalcy inside Russia, even as the Russian army continues to finish off the Ukrainians in Donbass and Zaporozhye region and in Kharkiv and Sumy regions. And that this is very much part of the Kremlin's overall grand strategy in prosecuting the war. And I suggested that the Ukrainian drone offensive, which at that time, we're talking about June, was mostly focused on attacking refineries, but which also involved a big attack on the city of Moscow, that the purpose of this drone offensive was precisely to disrupt and, if possible, shatter this sense of normalcy that the Kremlin has created inside Russia. And, well, it was surprising to me, a little surprising to me, to see this confirmed by the man, Brody, who is the supervisor, the actual supervisor of Ukraine's drone offensive. So this is from the Daily Telegraph. Robert Brody, Ukraine's drone chief, said the strikes against Wildberries were aimed at destroying the illusion of a comfortable, well-fed, peacetime life enjoyed by the obedient biomass of an aggressor country. Well, the language is awful. It dehumanizes the Russian people. But there it is, a straightforward admission that the ultimate purpose of the drone offensive is to shatter, to disrupt the sense of normalcy in Russia. And, well, is it in fact succeeding in doing that? Well, we've already had information that the situation with gasoline and diesel across Russia is stabilizing. The attacks on the Wildberries warehouses. Here, I think it's worth saying a few things about the Wildberries warehouses. A few people have made the point that Wildberries does sell dual-use equipment like helmets and camouflage gear and knives, things of that kind, and that it does say that these can be supplied to the military. And some people have said that this does confirm that Wildberries does indeed form part of Russia's logistics chain. And this, of course, has also been claimed by the Ukrainians, though we see that Robert Brody has somewhat disproved that claim. But as various other people have also pointed out, it's possible to find almost identical equipment also being sold via Amazon and other retailers, especially in the United States. And nobody seriously suggests that the warehouses that hold this equipment are in fact part of the military logistics chain. It is no doubt true, as the Financial Times is saying, that many Russians who want to support the special military operation buy this equipment via Wildberries, and then perhaps using Wildberries send this to the soldiers on the front lines. But this is going to have a minimal impact on the course of the war. Even the Financial Times, in its discussion of these attacks on Wildberries, was forced to concede that the goods that Wildberries trades in are overwhelmingly intended for the civilian market. So these attacks, exactly as Robert Brody said, are not ultimately intended to disrupt Russia's military campaign. any more than the attacks on the refineries were, or the attacks on the grain ships and the Sea of Azov. They were intended to cause problems domestically inside Russia, to create problems for Russia's internal domestic economy. In the run-up to parliamentary elections that are happening in Russia in the autumn, in order to put pressure on Vladimir Putin and perhaps to trigger protests within Russia against him, that will result either in the Russians agreeing to a ceasefire or the a political crisis leading to the fall of President Putin's government. Now, it's difficult to say fully how far-fetched, how frankly ridiculous this plan truly is. The idea that the huge Russian economy operating over what is by far the biggest country in the world is going to be seriously disrupted by attacks of this kind. The attacks on the oil refineries, as we see, caused only temporary problems in Russia's fuel situation. The attacks on Wildberries are going to cause great stress and trouble for the company itself. Apparently, 7 out of 10 of its largest warehouses have been hit by Ukrainian drones. It's not clear how extensive the damage has been. It's important to remember that warehouses are not built to the level of strength and resilience that industrial plants like refineries are. So, no doubt there's been significant damage, and no doubt it will be very costly for Wildberries to repair all this damage. And of course, there's all the small retailers who rely on Wildberries to sell their goods, and many of them are going to be very badly hit. And some of them are complaining that their businesses are now at risk. And lastly, there will be disappointed customers, people who have ordered goods from Wildberries, which cannot be delivered because of the damage done to the warehouses. But the warehouses will be repaired and they will be strengthened, and the warehouses will also be hardened against drone attack with netting, with military equipment, machine guns, and that kind of thing, and radars. The Wildberries operations will resume. I am confident that Wildberries' own costs will be met by the Kremlin, which has ample reserves and can easily afford to do this, and which no doubt realizes the strategic importance of Wildberries to the Russian economy. And, well, I suspect that the word will go out to the Russian banking sector to provide support to the small retailers who have been put under all this pressure because of the attacks on the warehouses and who have not been able to supply goods to their customers. In other words, this will be a blip, an unpleasant and ugly blip in what for the Russians has been in some ways an unpleasant summer, but it is not going to be more than that. Ideas, expectations that all of this is going to lead to to a massive uprising in Russia and will force change on the Russian government are foolish, to say the least. The contrast with the devastating effect on Ukraine of the closure of the entire Black Sea coast and of the sea of the port of Odessa could not be starker. And here I should say that over the last few days, there's been a series of extraordinarily plaintive and all but panic-stricken statements from Ukrainian officials lamenting the fact that Odessa and the other ports on the Black Sea are now closed and that Western ship owners are no longer prepared to send their ships there. And I have discussed in several recent programs the utterly relentless way in which the Russians continue their assault on Odessa and on the other Black Sea ports, the way in which the Russians have thrown off inhibitions in the way in which they carry out their attacks on Odessa and the other Black Sea ports, and the implacable language which they now use whenever the topic of the attacks on Odessa are brought up. We had an example of this from the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov. He was, of course, in Manila, attending the ASEAN summit meeting. And whilst there, shortly after his meeting, apparently, with the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, he was asked about the possibility of reviving the grain deal, the July 2022 agreement, which allowed for the unimpeded export of grain from Ukraine's Black Sea ports. And Lavrov responded as follows. With regard to the Black Sea initiative, that's the grain deal, the answer will be short. We have not received any proposals to that effect. This initiative by UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres clearly shows that it was a one-sided move and that the principles underlying its implementation were observed exclusively in the interests of the Ukrainian side. The UN officials played a rather questionable role in this regard, so this issue will no longer be brought up. So Lavrov shutting the door, in effect, on any discussion of any possible ceasefire in the Black Sea, in the Sea of Azov, and of course in Odessa. As it happens, the Ukrainians, as part of their great drone strike last night, also appear to have sent drones into the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov, but I have not heard of any damage done. The attack on the pumping station, the terminal of the Caspian Sea Consortium on the Black Sea has essentially closed. Kazakhstan has said that it is no longer willing to export oil through this terminal, which in effect means that Kazakhstan is now redirecting all its oil exports through other pipelines that go north through Russia. Just saying. Anyway, I read a report that the fact that oil from Kazakhstan is no longer being exported through the Black Sea is creating an economic crisis in Romania, where the country basically depends on oil imports from Kazakhstan. Of course, oil is now becoming generally in short supply with the closure of the Strait of Hormuz and the likely closure, or perhaps already existing closure, of the Red Sea. And what we see again is that the Ukrainian attack on the Caspian Sea, on the terminal, which is actually on the Black Sea, has had a further effect in affecting the economic interests of another European Union state. I am going to make a prediction, which is that in a year's time, the Black Sea will, in effect, once again have become a Russian lake. Little different from the Caspian Sea, a Russian lake which Russia will rather uneasily have to share with Turkey. But there will be essentially no shipping entering the Black Sea, which the Russians aren't monitoring or in ultimate control of. And even as I'm making this program, I've just seen a report that a ship apparently carrying coal from the United States to Ukraine has apparently suffered damage from either mines or drones in Romanian waters as it was seeking to approach the port of Constanza, the Romanian port of Constanza. For the moment, Constanza remains open, and of course, it is the port of a NATO country. There's been a detailed analysis of the potential option for Ukraine to redirect traffic that used to pass through its own Black Sea coasts through the port of through the port of Constanza in Romania. This report was done by a Russian team, run by a blog site called The Two Majors, which strongly supports the special military operation. So you can take this all with great skepticism if you please. But for the record, I think this analysis is correct. They say that the facilities, the railway and barge facilities, and the facilities in Constanza itself would only enable Ukraine, in the best and most optimal of circumstances, to reroute around a fifth of the trade that formerly passed through Odessa and its other Black Sea ports. So, if that is correct, and I believe it is, then Ukraine has suffered an economic blow that far exceeds in its total effect all of the damage that Ukraine has done to the Russian economy this summer, with the attacks on the refineries and the attacks on the Wildberries warehouses. In effect, most of its external trade has now been stopped. Well, anyway, that's the situation with Odessa. The Russians continue to hit Odessa every day. The Russian Defense Ministry continues to provide running accounts of its strikes on targets in Odessa, and in Ukraine's other Black Sea ports. Its latest report speaks of attacks on port infrastructure facilities in the four ports of Odessa, Chernomorsk, Yuzhny, Izmail, and Nikolaev, for example. And the Russian Defense Ministry says that 27 wet vessels used in the interest of the Ukrainian military were engaged, including 16 dry cargo ships, 10 bulk carriers, and one container ship. and all of these have been engaged in the last week. So we can see that the damage that has been done on Ukraine's economy has been enormous. It has attracted far less attention in the Western media than the attacks on wild berries or on the refineries. But this damage, this closing of the Ukrainian coast is likely to be permanent. Whereas, as we see in Russia, the gas situation there is stabilizing, is being sorted out. And I have no doubt that the situation with wild berries will soon be sorted out also. Anyway, that's the information I've received. I've just seen, incidentally, a further report on a Russian channel which says that the attack on the industrial facility in Kirov was carried out by a Ukrainian Flamingo cruise missile, and that the factory in Kirov was operated by the gigantic Russian Almaz-Ante conglomerate, and its main role, from what I can tell, was to make ejection seats for Russian fighter jets, which is obviously something that is very important. And you cannot make fighter jets without ejection seats. But I am sure that the facility will be repaired and will be brought back into production fairly quickly. Industrial plants, contrary to what many people believe, always can. So anyway, that is my overall view of the situation in the sky over Ukraine and over Russia over the last 24 hours. And of course, it's not just in the sky that things continue to happen. The Russian Defense Ministry this morning confirmed or claimed that Russian troops have now entered Alexeyevo-Druzhkovka. This is a suburb, if you like, of Druzhivka, which is the town immediately to the south of Kramatorsk and which lies between Konstantinivka, which the Russians have just captured, and Kramatorsk. And the Russian report, military report, reads as follows. First assault detachments enter outskirts of Alexeyevo-Druzhkovka. The acting chief of staff of a battalion of the 10th Tank Regiment with the call sign LIS told how the Yuzhnaya groups, that south group of forces south's units, continue a rapid offensive. The first assault detachments have entered the outskirts of Alexeyevo-Druzhkovka, started a small fight and pushed the enemy out of the centre of the settlement. The assault detachments are supported by separate tank units and drones. So, if we believe this report, which may or may not be true, I am not there myself on the ground, just saying, the Russians have broken into Alexeyevo-Druzhkovka with infantry and tanks, and their drones are operating, and they've entered the outskirts and are pushing towards the centre of the town. And, well, that report, which we got from a soldier, an officer, who is located there, seemed to suggest that the town is being stormed and that the defence, the Ukrainian defence there, is collapsing. But, well, perhaps we shouldn't put too much weight on what a single soldier is telling us from the front lines. Anyway, elsewhere, on every part of the front lines, the Russians continue to advance. If we're talking about the Zaporozhye region, the Russians are now advancing both in the western and the eastern part of the Zaporozhye region as their pincers gradually close around Orekhov. In Dobropilia, as I discussed in my program yesterday, they have captured the town of Belitskaya and appear to be pushing further and deeper towards Dobropilia, which is a very important objective. In further north, in the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk area, the Russians are converging from multiple directions towards Nikolaevka, immediately to the east of Slavyansk, and claim to have entered the territory of the Slavyansk thermal power plant, which is the main fortified Ukrainian position in this area. And perhaps most worryingly for the Ukrainians, the Russians appear to be broadening their offensive in Kharkiv region, capturing more villages there, even as the fighting in the town of Beli Kolodias continues. Incidentally, the new Ukrainian military chief, General Drapaty, he made his reputation, as well as his ultimately unsuccessful counteroffensive towards Kupiansk. He made his reputation in 2024, supposedly through his defense of Volchansk. But of course, Volchansk is also now under Russian control. Again, I have trouble myself understanding what are the successes that General Drapaty himself has achieved over the course of this war. Anyway, put all this aside, Lavrov has also been talking with increasing bitterness and anger about Anchorage. And, well, it's now clear that he's meeting with Rubio in Manila, which I discussed in my program yesterday, went every bit as badly as I thought it had. I obviously don't know the full details of what the two men discussed. It remains my view that Rubio probably brought up Russian military assistance to Iran, which I personally have no doubt it's taking place. Why wouldn't it? What we do know, because Lavrov is telling us this, is that Lavrov went on the attack with Rubio and directly criticized Rubio to his face about Rubio's recent claim that there was no agreement at the summit meeting in Anchorage. And of course, both Rubio and Lavrov were present at the meeting in Anchorage, and both heard all that was said there. And Lavrov seems to have reminded Rubio of it. And perhaps annoyingly for Rubio, Lavrov brought with him all the various statements, cop transcripts of all of the various statements that US officials who had attended the Anchorage summit, including Trump and Rubio himself, had made after the summit meeting, which essentially confirmed that an agreement, some kind of an agreement, had indeed been reached at Anchorage. I am not sure exactly what Rubio's response to all this was, but apparently at some point the discussion broadened into who was to blame for the fact that the Anchorage agreement was never put into effect. And Lavrov has been again talking about all of this after the meeting with Rubio. And Lavrov has said that it's obvious the Europeans and the Ukrainians did not want to act on the agreement that was reached in Anchorage. President Trump and the Americans assured Putin at the meeting that they would be, that he would be able to get the Ukrainians, Zelensky, to agree to the agreement that was reached in Anchorage. And, well, indirectly, Lavrov is blaming Trump himself for the fact that the whole meeting failed. He was not prepared to work through and act on what he promised. My own personal view about this is that, in effect, diplomatic interaction between the Trump administration and the Russians is now over. I think that the Russians no longer trust Trump or Rubio. They're very angry. They remain very angry about what happened in Valdai when the Ukrainians launched the drone attack on Valdai, as the Russians believe, with American complicity. And the Russians also are very, very angry with what they construe as an American betrayal of the agreements that were reached in Anchorage. I think any idea now that the United States, under Donald Trump, can engage the Russians in effective negotiations from this point onwards, pretty much on any subject, is now gone. Russian and American leaders will meet, Russian-American officials rather will meet, but I think the hopes of the first half of 2025 are fully and finally gone. And I think if the Americans think that the Russians are going to be helpful on Iran or anything like that, then they're going to be deeply disappointed. On the subject of Iran, I understand that Araghchi was in Moscow recently, and he had a meeting with Lavrov, and the Russians apparently expressed their continued support for Iran in this conflict. Lavrov, by the way, today has also had a meeting in Manila, he's still in Manila, with the Chinese foreign minister, Wang Yi. Wang Yi is also in Manila to attend the ASEAN meeting. And the Russians have provided it's not in Manila, it is a meeting of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in Kyrgyzstan. It's not always easy to keep up with Lavrov's journeys, but he went straight from Manila, apparently, to Kyrgyzstan, where the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is having a meeting. And there Lavrov met with Wang Yi. And we read, this is the Russian readout, that the two ministers expressed satisfaction with the positive momentum of Russian-Chinese relations, which have reached an unprecedented high level as a comprehensive partnership and strategic interaction. So, no visible sign of friction in the relations between the Russians and the Chinese, but essentially a collapse, as far as I can tell, in relations between the Trump administration and the Russians. Zelensky is due to travel to the United States to attend the funeral of Senator Lindsey Graham. He expects to meet Trump again. For the moment, President Trump continues to support Zelensky and the Ukrainians. He seems to have bought into the narrative that Ukraine has the initiative in the war. I wonder what will happen when he realizes that this is not the case and that he has been lied to again, when Donbass starts to fall and the other parts of the front line start to collapse, and expectations that might still exist in some quarters about some kind of internal crisis in Russia fail to materialize. He's just been led, I'm talking about Donald Trump now, up the garden path by the Israelis and other hardliners who have drawn him into a conflict with Iran to which there is no visible end in sight. And it's said that his relations with Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel have now indeed, and this is apparently for real, have now indeed essentially collapsed. Could it be that the same is going to turn out to be the case with Zelensky and the European leaders when Trump discovers that his initial instincts of last year, that Ukraine was losing and that the United States needed to extricate itself from the war, were right all along, and that the siren voices from Europe and from the neocons in Washington and from Zelensky, which brought him back to support for Ukraine, that they were wrong and lying all along. Well, that's President Trump's problem. By that point, I suspect he will have so many other problems to deal with that maybe, he won't even be thinking that much about Ukraine and its problems anymore. But one does indeed wonder what will happen if, at some point over the next few months, we do see a major military collapse in Ukraine, if Donbass is captured by the Russians, if Orekhov falls, if the Russians capture Sumy, and perhaps even Kharkiv. There have been reports of some kind of evacuation being ordered from Kharkiv, though I'm not sure whether that is true or not. But, well, I suspect that at that point, the cycle that we see in the West of euphoria, then panic, then despondency replacing panic, then demands for escalation in order to somehow stabilize the situation, we will see all of that revert again, only from an even weaker position. In fact, a much weaker position. And I'm going to here express my own opinion that if we do get into a situation where there is no sign of a peace, where Donbass has fallen and the Russians are advancing and perhaps advancing towards Kiev itself, that at that moment demands for the insertion of Western ground troops into Ukraine will intensify, and we might actually see the first moves in that direction being made. That, of course, will be the absolute point of no return. The Russians have repeatedly said, in fact, they've said again over the last few days, that they would treat the appearance of Western troops in Ukraine as essentially an act of war. And for the record, parts of the Russian media are now discussing certain military exercises that have been taking place in Poland. And they've been drawing conclusions, which I hope, by the way, are the wrong conclusions, that these exercises are in fact a rehearsal for the deployment of European troops onto the territory of Ukraine itself. Anyway, we will see where all this goes. But for the moment, at least, negotiations, talks, peace, all of that is gone. Lavrov himself has again said that with the failure of Anchorage, there is only one thing for the Russians to do, and that is to focus on fighting and going on and achieving victory. In fact, his language here has been very powerful. And, well, I suspect that that reflects the wider mood in Russia at the moment. And, by the way, the attacks on wild berries and all of that are going to reinforce that Russian view, the view that war, victory, is the only way to achieve what for the Russians would be a lasting and successful peace. Anyway, that's, as I said, where we are in the conflict in Ukraine. Meanwhile, the other conflict in the Persian Gulf goes on. There is increasing talk from the President of the United States of a massive strike by the United States against Iran. There have been many strikes by the United States against Iran. None of them have achieved the objectives that the President imagined, and I don't see why this one would. And the latest topic of discussion, brilliantly sent up on his programmes by my colleague and friend Alex Christoforou, is Pickaxe Mountain, the other mountain, granite mountain, beneath which the Iranians are supposed to have hidden their stockpiles of enriched uranium and their remaining centrifuges. Well, no doubt we will have another attack on Pickaxe Mountain. No doubt President Trump will tell us that the entire Iranian nuclear program has been obliterated. But of course, how that resolves the problem of the Strait of Hormuz and perhaps the Red Sea, both of which are or may be closed to shipping. And some reports say that the Iranians have now indeed mined the Strait of Hormuz. They've actually sown sea mines in the Strait of Hormuz. So it's no longer just drones and missiles that prevent ships traveling through the Strait of Hormuz. How an attack on Pickaxe Mountain solves anything, I am personally completely unable to see. But in the meantime, inventories of oil decline, energy shortages grow, and Kaya Kallas demands that ships carrying Russian oil in the Indian Ocean should be impounded by EU navies. Carrying Russian oil to whom exactly? To India? The European Union has now passed, as part of its 21st sanctions package, a provision which supposedly entitles the European Union to confiscate oil on ships of the so-called shadow fleet that are seized and to dispose of that oil. The provision includes express wording that no part of the sale of this oil, should it occur, should be reimbursed to the Russians. Well, I'm not sure how this changes maritime law. In fact, I'm sure it doesn't. And what is that, if not the confiscation of cargoes on the high seas in times of peace, something which could once be called piracy, and which I suspect is piracy. But that still appears to be the route upon which the European Union is travelling. I don't see any sign of a change of course. As I said, if Donbass and all of the other positions in eastern Ukraine start to crumble, well, it'll be interesting to see how the people who come up with these strange plans, how they react. But anyway, this is where I'm going to finish the program today. Well, just to remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.